So yeah, thank you, Micah, for special music. My introduction is going to be unusually long today. That's no indication of the length of the sermon, though. It'll be shorter. I was noticing in the last several weeks, we've had shorter. We were supposed to have shorter services because we didn't have as many hymns and those kind of things. But I apologize because I've noticed that I've been going much longer, and we've still been going an hour and a half. So I'm going to try not to do that today, but my introduction is going to be a bit long, but it's important because it's going to set the stage for what I want to talk about today. There's been a lot of conversation over the past few weeks and months regarding government mandates imposed upon people because of COVID, COVID-19. It's hard to believe it's been 5 months now that we've been dealing with all of this. In some regards, it seems like it just started. Other times, it feels like it's been a nightmare that'll never end. So it just depends on how much you've been impacted by it. What has particularly upset many people is the fact that the data does not support the level of government overreach we've had to endure. I'm going to show that here in a moment. And I think that's what's made a lot of people frustrated and upset. There has been media pushing a one-sided agenda, a narrative that's skewed reality, and I'm going to show you data to support this. We're constantly bombarded with fear-mongering is a term I like to use, just constantly bombarding people to make them fearful, believing that it's a pandemic of epic proportions, wiping out 20% of the population or more. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a virus. Please don't misunderstand that. But people have the perception that this is much like the Spanish flu of 1918, where it is estimated that 500 million people were infected and deaths ranged from 2 to 2.5%. Of course, we know record keeping back then isn't what we have today, so they don't have an exact number. Some argue it was as high as 10 to 20%. But 17 to 50 million is generally accepted, the number of people that died from the Spanish flu. So how bad are people's perceptions compared to reality? The Washington Examiner posted online on July 30th a graphic, which I'm going to put up here in a moment, that illustrates the results of a study. I have the COVID study here, an opinion tracker. It was done by KEXT CNC, which is one of the world's third largest communication groups. They're considered to be independent. They're objective, no real agenda, but just they did a poll to find out people's perceptions and then compared that with the data. This poll was conducted of a sample of citizens. They categorized them by those in the UK, Sweden, Germany, France, United States, and Japan. The poll revealed that Americans have a wildly overstated view of the COVID-19's impact with respect to total infections and total deaths as a percent of the population. For example, a poll question was, how many people in your country have had COVID-19? That was the question. Americans answered 20%. 20% of the population, that's 66 million people. The reality is 1%. The poll question was, how many people in your country have died from COVID-19? Americans answered 9%. 29.5 million people have died, according to this people's perceptions. The reality is 0.04%. So if you were to contract COVID, you have a 96.6% chance of survival. So what does that look like in a graph? The top is, again, each one of those dots is 100,000 people. The perception is 20% of Americans have had it, 9% of Americans have died from it. The reality is down below, 1% of Americans have had it, and 4%, or 0.04%, have died. You see that little red dot way over there on the left on the bottom? Americans overstated the death number by 225 times. 225 times That's how much it's overstated. I only shared that because I want to illustrate the effect it's had on our thinking. Right? They have scared people, and I think you'll see as I go through the sermon today why it's important we remember that. Because you'll see as we go through this sermon, it's relevant. People in France, Sweden, the UK, they all overstated that same number by 100 times. You know, we overstated it 225 times, you know, 2,250%. They overstated it by 100 times. People in Denmark, they were off by 300 times, right? So a little bit more. But if you remember, I quoted a statement in Denmark. I'll quote here in a moment. So there's probably a reason why they're even higher. These perceptions that we have, they impact our behavior, they impact public policy, right? They impact a lot of things. They impact economic costs, our decision making. A lot of things about life are impacted by our perception of what's happening, maybe not the reality of what's happening. And again, I'll say again, there is a virus, please don't get me wrong, but maybe not to the degree that some people have been led to believe. Along with these kind of fearful tactics, if I can use that term, governments start enacting mandates. These only fuel people's fears. You know, oh, it must really be really, really, really bad if they're making us do this or making us do that. And then along with it, they leverage these fears to use social pressure to gain conformity. You know, everybody has to do this or everybody has to do that. Forcing people to wear masks, coupled with shaming people who don't, you know, is one of the latest things that has been going on. I was trying to look up who it was. I think it was the first Bush president. I think it was Barbara Bush, his wife, who had an anti-bullying campaign as part of her being the first lady. I believe it was her. And if you remember, she brought awareness to the fact that there was bullying in schools that was even leading to suicides, and that it had to stop. You've got to stop bullying people to conform to certain things because it was leading to suicides. Those days are gone. You know, we're in a time now where adults are actually being encouraged to pressure people to comply. And masks, right, may only be the beginning. The federal government and Yale are currently holding clinical trials on how best to persuade Americans into taking the COVID vaccines when they're available. The study is published at a government website. It's clinicaltrials.gov, clinicaltrials.gov. If you want the whole URL, send me an email, I'll send it to you. Some of what's going to be studied are ways to use guilt, shame, or anger to get people to conform. Right? So as we go through the sermon today, what I want to emphasize is the mask is not the issue. Right? It's not the issue. We need to be thinking at a higher level and be thinking deeper as to how this is going to impact us longer term. And I'll get to that here. Again, my intro is a bit long. But at this clinical trial website, some of what, again, is being studied is using guilt, shame, or anger. So at the website, here is the position being posited to the participants. The message is about the danger that COVID-19 presents to the health of one's family and community, and the best way to protect them is by getting vaccinated, and society must work together to get enough people vaccinated, as many as possible. And so the guilt message is to ask a participant to imagine the guilt they're going to feel if they don't get vaccinated and then they spread the disease. So they're going to try to guilt you and say, oh yeah, I should do this, I should get vaccinated. The embarrassment message is to ask a participant to imagine the embarrassment they're going to feel if they don't get vaccinated and spread the disease, and then they contact, trace it back to you, and then everybody's pointing a finger at you because you spread it. And the anger message is to ask that participant to imagine the anger they're going to feel if they don't get vaccinated and they spread the disease. So I share this because there is a methodology being developed to confront you if you don't comply. What we're going through right now might just be a dress rehearsal, right? A trial run of much, much bigger things to come. And so we need to be thinking about these types of things. Notice Revelation 13, because I'm sure at some point thoughts of this came to mind, Revelation chapter 13. I'm sure many people have considered what's happening, the conditioning, society forcing people to comply, and how does that play out in the long term. As I said, remember that people from Denmark were 300 times, they inflated the numbers 300 times. If you remember one of the first webcasts I gave when we were staying at home, I read to you that the Denmark's parliament unanimously passed an emergency coronavirus law. This is in March they passed the law, right when everything started, which gives health authorities powers to force testing, treatment, and quarantine with the backing of police. That was back in March. What was particularly noteworthy was that the law also allowed authorities to force people to be vaccinated. So you can imagine why people in Denmark probably have a heightened awareness that this must be really, really, really bad. Right. It also prohibited access to public institutions, access to supermarkets. You're not allowed to go in and buy food if you're not vaccinated. Right. Shops, public and private nursing homes, and public transportation to anyone who doesn't receive the vaccine, which sounds a lot like what we're going to read here in Revelation 13, beginning in verse 16, breaking into the context. He calls it all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man. His number is 666. Masks and vaccines are not the mark of the beast. Right? What I want us to think about is an environment we're living in now where pressure will be put on people to conform to something. Right? That's worthy of our consideration, worthy of prayer, worthy of study and meditation. Right? There'll come a day when something of this magnitude will come. This isn't it. Right? Masks are not the mark. Right? Vaccines, not the mark. Right? But there's coming a day. And so, well, as I keep emphasizing, what we're going through might just be conditioning, right, to those type of things. Here's another article that was in USA Today on August 6th. It was an op-ed piece. Defeat COVID-19 by requiring vaccination for all. It is not un-American. It is patriotic. Make vaccines free. Don't allow religious or personal objections. And punish those who won't be vaccinated. They are threatening the lives of others. Right. One more example before I tell you where I'm going with this. Here's another example that shows this is more about compliance and conformity than it really is about health. August 10th, Kansas City Star had an article that says, in an email to employees sent out on July 31st, there you go, the head of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources not only reminded employees of the governor's mask order going into effect, he also said that every DNR employee must wear a mask even while on a video conference. Also, quote, wear your mask even if you are at home alone to participate in a virtual meeting that involves being seen. Employees wearing masks while video conferencing sets a good example. So it is more than health, right? There's more to this. All of this was an unusually long introduction to a topic I want to look at today. It's a topic I know that we've been wrestling with as I've talked to various people and over the last few months, and we're trying to find balance. Should I obey the government? Should I obey the government? How do I balance the scripture that tells us to be subject to the governing authorities with the one that says I should obey God rather than man? Do they contradict each other? I'll tell you right up front, they do not contradict each other. It is possible to submit to authority and disobey. And we're going to look at that today. We're going to look at examples in our Bible that show that. And if we can understand that, it makes a lot of what we're going through a whole lot easier to process and understand, you know, where we draw a line in the sand. So a tougher question might be, you know, when do I push back? You know, where is my line in the sand? And how do I balance all this out? So let's see if we can get more clarity. I've titled the sermon, God or Government. God or Government. Come with me to Romans 13, because this is one of the verses that often comes up. Romans 13. A little background on the book of Romans. Paul's writing of Romans is a bit different from his other writings. Most scholars agree that it lacks a bit of a personal touch. Paul didn't establish the church in Rome. He had not yet been there. It had sprung up on its own. So he had a kind of a distant relationship. He knew of them, but had never been there. And so in that regard, the tone of Romans is a bit different. F.F. Bruce in Tyndale's commentary says this lack of personal touch is because of the fact that he had not founded or established that, and so he had no personal contact with them. But this epistle to the church in Rome was written from Corinth in around 58 AD. If you remember, Nero's persecutions started around 64, so this is prior to that. But it was in the fourth year of Nero. Paul had organized a collection from churches in Corinth. You can read about that in 1 Corinthians and in 2 Corinthians, where they had taken up collections. He was going to take that money to Jerusalem. And so as he writes to the church in Rome, he tells them, look, I'm about to depart for Jerusalem. I'm going to go there. I'm going to leave the money with them. Then I'm going to go to Spain. And on my way to Spain, I want to stop off in Rome, and I look forward to seeing you. And it's in this context that Paul then lets them know that he plans to come to them. And in Romans 13, verse 1, notice what he says. We'll read a few verses here. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. For if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, verse 5, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, custom to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, to the casual reader, or somebody just glancing at this and reading it for the first time, they might look at this and think this is kind of an extreme statement. I mean, clearly, Paul doesn't understand the persecution these people are going to be under, so he must be out of touch with what he's saying here. Some would tempt to dismiss this saying for that reason, that he's just out of touch. He doesn't really know what he's saying. And there's people that try to argue that point. However, we do know, you can put in your notes Acts 18, verse 2, we know that there's a case where he meets Aquila and Priscilla. It's noted there they departed from Rome when Emperor Claudius had told the Jews that they were banished from Rome. So he was quite aware that there was persecution put on people. So it's not that he didn't know this, and yet he still wrote what we read here. Being obedient to civil authorities is a position that Paul repeats often in his writing. He doesn't deviate from that position. Notice Titus chapter 3. We're going to come back to Romans 13, but notice Titus chapter 3. This is a statement he says repeatedly. Titus chapter 3. In verse 1, Paul here is exhorting Titus to remind the brethren. It says, remind them, verse 1, to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility to all men. And so the word that's translated here in English, subject to, you can do a word study on this word, is hupotesos, right? Hupotesos, subject to. And if you look at the Greek, it means, again, subordinate, under obedience, subject to. Zodiates' word study says to place in order, to place under in an orderly fashion, to place into rank. Right? So return now to Romans 13, verse 1, because it's the same word that we just read there, Romans 13, verse 1 again. You know, words matter. And sometimes as we translate to the English, we have a concept that certain words mean the same thing, and we often misread just because of our language. Romans 13, verse 1 again. That's Romans 3. It didn't make sense. Let every soul be subject to, same word again, hupoteso, subject to the governing authorities. Subject to. That's the... Paul writes about that over and over in Scripture. But did Paul really mean we should have absolute obedience to civil authority? Absolute obedience to civil authority. Is that what Paul means here? Well, let's look at who Paul's talking to. Number one, He's speaking certainly to the brethren in Rome, but who else? Every soul. Every soul. Everybody. He wasn't just writing to the church members. He's basically saying every human being on earth is to be subject to governing authorities. And that's what Paul continues to write about. And so that includes you and me. Still applies today. We are subject to governing authorities. Barnes notes, the word here denotes the kind of submission which soldiers render to their officers. It's kind of understanding your place in the order of things and that we are subject to them. Barnes continues, it implies subordination, a willingness to occupy our proper place to yield to the authority of those over us. A child is subject to their parents. They know their place in the family, and there's order and there's accountability. Barnes continues, the word here does not designate the extent of the submission, but merely enjoins it in general. The general principle will be seen to be that we are to obey in all things which are not contrary to the law of God. There's actually two conditions I'll get to towards the end here where we would remain subject to authority and not obey them. It sounds confusing, doesn't it? Hopefully if I do my job by the time it's done, it won't be confusing at all. It'll make perfect sense because they don't contradict themselves at all. Barnes notes that in a military use of the word, it means to arrange in a manner under the command of a leader, and in civilian or non-military use, it's a voluntary attitude of giving in, cooperating, assuming responsibility, and carrying a burden. Paul uses the word submit, not obey. And I've been deliberately saying that, right? There's a time to submit, right? There's a time that you don't obey, but you still submit. Paul said that we are to submit to authority. It simply means that we recognize authority over us. That's all it means. It's acknowledging our place, our subordinate place in a hierarchy. We have a governor of our state. Whether or not we like what he says or does, he is our governor. We have to recognize that. He has certain authority. Why is it that he says to submit to or recognize or acknowledge civil authorities over us? Why do we do that? Paul tells us why we do that, latter part of verse 1. For there's no authority except from God. The authorities that exist are appointed by God. We submit to our governor because God is over that governor, and we're obeying God. God's allowed that person to be in place. You know, we may want to go out in the parking lot and have a debate over why he's in place. It doesn't matter, right? God has allowed that man to be in that position. And so we obey God, who is supreme, governs all things, and allowed that man to be in that position. And so we are subject to him because we're subject to God. Now, our governor doesn't understand that's why we're obedient, right? But that is why. Paul says that's why we do it, because God, again, all authority, there is no authority except from God, and all authority exists are appointed by God. So again, it's clear why we obey. Because if we continue, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. I don't want to stand as one before God saying, well, I obey you, but I don't obey the guy that you allow to be in charge. Right? That's kind of an awkward position to be in. Right? And again, as we go on, I think it'll become even more clear where this is all going. And so this is the emphasis here. Submitting to civil authorities because we are submitting to God. That's why we're doing it. Right? We do it because God said so. And we are obedient to him. As we just read here in verse 2, it is God who allows these things to exist. If we resist against them, we're resisting against God. And then Paul goes on to talk about living a free life without fear by just being obedient. And these are things we know, right? You drive down the road going to speed limit, whether you agree with the speed limit or not, you can live a life without fear. You push that limit and now you're all tense and you're looking in your mirrors and all that because you're not following the authority. And so I was commenting this morning when that show Cops came out years ago. I probably watched a few episodes. After a while, I realized this is just getting redundant. It's the same thing all the time. You know, somebody does some knucklehead does something. He runs from the cops. They finally catch up to him. They pull him over. Why were you running? I didn't do nothing. You didn't do anything. Right? I was afraid. Why were you afraid? You were chasing me. Well, why were we? It's just comical, right? And After a while, it was just like pointless. But that's what Paul's saying. You got nothing to fear if you're just living within the law. The real challenge is to submit when we don't like the leader or we don't like what they're doing. That's really what it comes down to, right? When we don't like what he's saying or we don't like what he's doing. Notice 1 Peter chapter 2. Because the only way we're going to really come to grips and be at peace and learn where we're at is to just process all this in our thinking and our prayer and put it in its proper context. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using liberty as a cloak for vice, but as bondservants of God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king, respect the festival coordinator, do what we're told. You see what I mean? Like, when you begin to understand why we're doing it, right? It's about being decent in order. And, you know, when you think about it, I popped in my head this morning. You know, think about we're going to the distant feast sites. We're going to Gatlinburg. There's going to be 700 people going to Gatlinburg, right? Do the people of Gatlinburg want 700 people coming into their city? I don't know. Maybe they're nervous about that. But if we respect the rules that are in Gatlinburg, whatever they are, I don't know what they are, but when I get there, I'm going to find out what they are. But if I respect that, right, should we not show that respect and that love and care for them, whether I like their rules or not? Because what happens if we don't and then we leave and they have a break? Guess who gets blamed for it? We do, whether it's our fault or not. So, you know, we need to look at, you know, as it's spelled out here, you know, doing these things, as it says, verse 15, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. We don't want to be blamed for things that aren't our fault. And the way we can mitigate that is just complying. Whether we agree or not isn't even the point. Let's now go to the book of Daniel, because Daniel is often an example that gets brought up in this discussion. So let's go there, because Daniel is a great example. Because people often say, well, what about Daniel? Didn't Daniel stand up against civil authorities? And all right, well, that's a good point. So let's go look at that. And because he's actually a perfect example of what I'm talking about, Daniel chapter 1. Now, a little background here. Daniel's about 15 to 20 years old in Daniel chapter 1. Josephus writes in Antiquities of the Jews, book 10, that he was probably part of a royal family. So were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So put yourself in the context of being at one point part of a royal family, right? That's where you're at. And now these events are about to unfold in your life, right? So, and how would we feel, or how would we handle these things? Daniel chapter 1, just want to read a couple of verses to set the stage here. Verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes to Jerusalem and besieges it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land. I want to stop there. The Lord gave Jehoiakim into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. They weren't just overtaken. It was a deliberate act. Why? I don't know. God knows why, whether we know why or not. So put yourself in Daniel's place. You're part of a royal family. This happens. God did it. He allowed it. Put you now under subjection under King Nebuchadnezzar. So again, put yourself in that position. The Lord gave him over. Drop down to verse 6. From among those from Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So that sets the stage, right? They were in one state of life. Now they are in another because the Lord gave them over. So let's go to Daniel chapter 6 now. Because God always has a plan, even when we don't know what it is, we don't see what it is, and that's the part that usually frustrates us the most, because we really want to know what the plan is. It would help calm us down. Daniel chapter 6. Here now Darius the Mede is king. He's fifth or sixth in succession after Nebuchadnezzar. You know, Daniel's going to spend, from that event in Daniel 1, about 70 years being a servant under Gentile kings. So, again, put yourself in that position. Once you were part of a royal family, and now 70 years under Gentile kings. Daniel chapter 6 is a story we're familiar with, so I'll just hit a few highlights. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one. So Daniel had a pretty good position. We know that, verse 3, Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So again, this got people uncomfortable. They didn't like the fact, you know, Daniel's kind of rising up above, setting himself above everybody else. Verse 4, the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. And we know the story, right? They plot against him. They have the king pass an edict. So we'll look at verse 7. The governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Verse 9, the king signed the decree. Verse 10, and this is where people say, see, Daniel didn't submit to the king. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home and in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Now there's a long narrative in the Kyle and Dillich commentary that gives some background as to what's going on here. I'll try to surmise it. Basically, those individuals that were in the kingdom that served pagan gods, they had no problem in their customs and their teachings praying to their gods through another medium. So praying to their god through Darius the king was not a problem for them. It was just that's part of what they did. So this was not a big deal. They could do that. Daniel couldn't do that. Daniel only prayed to the one true God. And so Daniel was cornered into a circumstance that there was no possible way he could obey this edict. But you'll see he still submits to the king. So again, I'll just read the latter part of what Kyle and Dillich's commentary says. Quote, speaking of the heathen nations, they could all do this without violating their consciences, for since in their own manner they served the Median king as the son of their gods, they served their gods in him. The Jews, however, were not in the condition of being able to regard the king as a manifestation of Jehovah. He was boxed in a corner. There was no way he could do this. And thus for them there was involved in the law truly a religious persecution. So here Daniel's not trying to provoke the king. He didn't suddenly go to his upper room and open up the windows, make sure he could be seen. In fact, he knelt. But the point to note there in verse 10, it was his custom since his early days. He always did this. And they knew he always did this. And they were going to go wait for him to do this. It was a complete setup. But Daniel was not going to stop doing what has always been his custom. Daniel was merely remaining obedient to God no matter the consequences. That's the lesson of Daniel. He was going to continue to obey God regardless of the consequences. The word submit that we looked at earlier does not imply complete obedience. There's two conditions. Here's the two conditions I begin to wrap up. Two conditions where we must not obey authority. Number one, we do not obey laws that command us to do something God forbids. We do not obey laws that command us to do something God forbids. Daniel could not keep this ordinance, couldn't obey the king's decree, because Daniel only prayed to the one true God. He didn't pray to God through another medium. It was not possible for Daniel to obey. But Daniel still submitted, right? Notice Daniel 6, verse 20. And this, I hope, is where you begin to see the nuance. When he came to the den, we know the story. Daniel is thrown in the lion's den, right? Because, again, he didn't obey the king, but he subjected himself to the king's authority. Like basically said, right? I can't obey you, but you're still king, so do with me what you will. Okay, I'm throwing you in the lion's den. Fine, throw me in the lion's den. You can do that. You're the authority. I'm submitting to you. He gets tossed in. He comes out. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying, Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, notice his submission. O king, he still recognized him as the king. O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, shut the lion's mouth. But the point is, he still submitted to the king and said, I can't obey you. No matter the consequences, do with me as you will. You're the king. He didn't run away. He just simply said, I can't obey. And he was willing to stand up for truth, for what was right, regardless of the consequences. You know, we were talking after church this morning how even somebody who goes to their boss and says, I can't work on the Sabbath. I can't do it. It's impossible. Can't obey that. Well, then I'm going to fire you. Okay, you have the authority to do that. You're still subject to that authority. It's the same principle, right? And so Daniel here was forced into a situation he could not do something that God forbid. But he still was subject to the king, and whatever the king was going to do to him, and he accepted that, but he didn't obey. And I hope you see that subtle nuance there. That principle is seen elsewhere in Scripture. Go back, we won't for the sake of time, review Egyptians, the fact that the Egyptians required the Jewish midwives to kill the Jewish baby boys, remember? And they said, can't do it. We can't commit murder. Right? And had they been found out for doing that, they would have been severely punished. So you have that account. You could look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Same story, right? With King Nebuchadnezzar. You're the king. We can't obey you. We're not going to obey you. So do with us what you have to do. Throw us in the fire? Fine, throw us in the fire. We're either going to die or God's going to save us, but we're not obeying you. But you are king and you have the authority to do with us what you want to do. We recognize and we submit to your authority. It is totally humanly possible to submit to authority and not obey. It is possible. Right? So that's another example of that. So I ask the question then, what might our government require of us today that God clearly forbids? Masks isn't one of them. Sorry, I know you're hoping I'd say prove that. Can't prove that one, right? But it's something we should be thinking about, meditating on, considering, praying about. Right? What might our government require of us today that God clearly forbids? That would be the time not to obey. But then you're subject to whatever they're going to do to you. You submit to them. See, that's the hard part. That's the real hard part. The second condition, so let me repeat the first one, right? We do not obey laws that command us to do something God forbids. The second is we do not obey laws that command us not to do something God requires. It's the flip. Not to do something God requires. Notice Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4. Peter and John are arrested. They're brought before the Sanhedrin. They're told to stop speaking about this guy Jesus. They don't want to hear it anymore. It's stirring up a whole lot of problems for them. They refuse because it violated what they believed Jesus had actually given them, commanded them to do, go share the good news with everybody everywhere. Acts chapter 4, verse 15, but when they had commanded them to go aside out of the council, they conferred amongst themselves, saying, what shall we do to these men? For indeed that a notable miracle has been done through them is evident to all who dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it. But so that it spreads no further among the people, let us severely threaten them that from now on they speak to no man in his name. So they called them and commanded them to speak at all. They commanded them not to speak at all, nor teach in the name of Jesus. Verse 19. But Peter and John answered and said to them, whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than to God, you judge. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard. And so when they further threatened them, they let them go, finding no way of punishing them. So here they were, you know, severely threatened. I don't know what that threat was. I imagine it was pretty severe. But they said, all they're asking is just don't speak of this guy's name. And it says again that they were severely threatened. So again, if our government passes a law, maybe that forbids us from assembling for worship, right? Submission to that law doesn't require obedience. Right? Submission to the government doesn't require obedience. Because if we believe God commands us to assemble on the Sabbath, we have to assemble on the Sabbath. Now, we can have a long discussion of what the word assemble means, right? That's a whole discussion of and by itself. If the government passes a law forbidding us from praying, We would not obey that. We'd be subject to whatever they want to do to us, but I would not obey that. So these are the kind of things that we should be thinking about again. So this now brings us to, I guess I got a little bit ahead of myself. We're fine. Acts chapter 5. I want to go now to this memory verse that I know many have been pondering. Again, the Sanhedrin had strictly ordered them to stop preaching in Jesus' name. But notice here how courageous they were. Notice in Acts 5, beginning of verse 20, they are now imprisoned again. And in verse 19, an angel of the Lord opened the prison doors, brought them out, and said, right, so here you go, yay, we're delivered, right? Angel of the Lord comes to us, we're delivered from this, we're released from prison, right? My thought is, let's get out of Dodge. Let's get out of town. But notice what the angel tells them. Go, stand in the temple and speak to the people all the words of this life. Now, there's a part of me that would be going, you want me to do what? That's how I got in here in the first place, right? But that's what they were told to do. Verse 21, and when they heard that, they entered the temple early in the morning and taught. But the high priest and those with him came and called the council together with all the elders of the children of Israel and sent to the prison to have them brought. I'm sure they knew exactly where they were at, right? But when the officers came and did not find them in the prison, they returned and reported, saying, indeed, we have found the prison shut securely and the guards standing outside. So again, now Barclays, I'll interject here quickly. Barclays says, to obey that command was an act of almost reckless audacity, and yet they went. Right? Think about it. Put yourself, this is what we were doing, how we ended up in prison. Now you got us out, you want us to go do this again? It wouldn't even make sense to us. How many of us would second guess what we were told to do and decide to do something else? Barclay continues, they were men of principle, and their ruling principle was that in all circumstances, obedience to God must come first. Here's a good question to ask. They never asked, is this course of action safe? They asked, is this what God wants me to do? You can submit to authority and not obey by simply asking, is this course of action safe? Is this what God wants me to do? If God says I am commanded to do this, I'm going to do it. And it's not about, well, it's not safe to do it. No, that's what God expects of me. The guards go out, they get the apostles. They said, I think they knew exactly where to go find them. Notice now verse 28. Bring them back to the Sanhedrin. The high priest asked them, did we not strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us. Which now brings us to this familiar, well-known verse, verse 29. But Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. You can throw us in prison again because we're subject to you, but we're going to obey God. You see the difference now? They don't contradict. They actually work together. You can submit to governing authorities, and yet there's times when you don't obey them. But you're subject to what they're going to do to you. That's the essence of it. You know, it's funny because, you know, through all of this, as people get worked up over masks or different mandates, you know, my wife and I were chuckling this past week and we were talking to others about how, you know, put it in this context, you know, Christ returns, people are resurrected, and we're sitting around talking, and you're talking to somebody, and you're like, oh, yeah, there was this period, we had a mask, and the government was crushing us, coming down on us, it was hard, it was miserable, and they're going, yeah, I was one of those Christians burned at the stake in Nero, but that mask thing, that's tough. That sounds really hard. You know, it's like, when we go back and look at how Christians have been persecuted, this is nothing, right? But sometimes we have to step back and laugh and put it in context, right? But I wouldn't want to be having a conversation with somebody, oh yeah, I was sawn in half. But that mask thing, yeah, that's tough stuff there, buddy. I mean, I would feel ashamed, right? I believe what we're going through is just a trial run, bottom line. This is just a trial. To prepare us for a time when something stronger is going to be pressed upon us, and we're going to have to know where we stand individually, in some of these things that government, the beast power, fill in the blank, is going to put upon us. You have to be ready to remain subject to authority and obey God. And that means whatever the authority chooses to do to you, they're going to do. but we have to obey God rather than man. So hopefully we see there's no contradiction between these two verses. Every soul, Romans 13:1, should be subject to governing authorities. In Acts 5:29, we ought to obey God rather than man. They go hand in hand. Both of these are expected of God's people. We have to learn to do both. I want to finish in 1 Timothy chapter 2, final scripture, 1 Timothy 2. First Timothy chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, everybody. Verse 2, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence.